There we are. Here we are with Sid Burrows and John Barg interview. There we are. We're sitting in Sid's living room with a nice view of Comox Bay. So Sid, I was just going to start off with a couple of kind of background questions just to kind of get an idea of where you were coming from before enlisting.
Okay.
So where were you born?
I'm born in Burnaby over here.
Okay.
Between New Westminster and Vancouver, uh-huh. A place called Burnaby.
Yeah.
I was born there. And I grew up there and in White Drop, mm-hmm. down near the border. And then we moved to New Westminster and I graduated high school in New Westminster.
Okay.
And then I went worked for the Bank of Commerce for a couple of years until the Korean War started. And that's when I joined up. Well, I was 19 then when I joined up.
No,
in June of 1950.
Okay.
The Korean War started.
Okay, and was that like your reason for enlisting?
Yeah, well, my dream was always to be a pilot, and there I was, finally, you know, I'm going to become a pilot, which is just a dream.
So lucky.
And I made it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's a dream for sure.
Yeah.
So when you enlisted, do you remember your first couple of days in service? What those days were like?
Well, we were sent to RCF station near London, Ontario, called Crumlin. And my buddy and I, we both joined together, and so we asked them if we could, they give us train tickets, and said, well, they would, and said, can we go to Crumlin by a bus? And they said, sure, as long as it doesn't cost more than the train. So my buddy and I took a bus to California to see an old friend of ours who lived there, and then we took the bus all the way through the United States, through Chicago. I remember Chicago because we stopped off and saw our first National Hockey League game in Chicago. It blew our minds. The New York Rangers and Chicago Blackhawks.
Yeah.
And then we went from there to London, Ontario, checked into the base, and that's when it all starts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they cut your hair off and give you, well, we were best basketball players, so we didn't have long hair anyway. And you start by, you're issued a bedroll, and we're all in double bunks in the barracks, and met all the guys that were going to be on. And what as well, there was a selection unit to see if you're suitable as an officer.
Mm-hmm.
So they put us, we got uniforms, and then how to shine shoes, and then we did marching, and we went through lectures of all kinds of lectures. I remember the king was still the king. And we had our laws in the Air Force or in the Armed Forces, was called the King's Regulations, and so which are the laws of the whatever. And so we learned the King's Regulations, and we had to go through all of these things. Well, a lot of it was geography and whatnot. And we went through tests of all kinds, where they wanted to prove us if we could operate effectively as an officer. And,
right.
And we started with over 100 guys in my class. And gradually the guys started disappearing, and we didn't really know what was going on, but they just eliminated them. And I guess they didn't
process of elimination.
And fortunately, my buddy and I, who were both basketball players, we got on the base team, and the coach was one of our instructors. And so I think he put in a good word for us. we were playing downtown London, Ontario, and playing some pretty hot teams, and we did very well anyway.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I recall later is one of our instructors was a flight lieutenant named Ken Brown, and one of his lectures, one of it was to learn what medals were. You know, started with the Victoria Cross,
right.
And the DSO, Distinguished Order, and then the DFC and the AFC and all that. And he was wearing a rare medal that he didn't say much about it. And we didn't find out later, but it was called the CGM. And we found out that later, Conspicuous Gallantry Medal.
Mm.
And he was an original dam buster.
Wow.
He was a Flight Sergeant Ken Brown, and he bombed one of the dams by himself.
In Squadron 617 back in the war.
Yeah, during the war. And yeah. This is one of our instructors, and we had no idea.
That's amazing.
Which was my life in the Air Force, was meeting these fantastic heroes from the war.
I guess right after the war, all these guys would have been, like, you know, fresh and...
Yeah, they were all around. Yeah, well, yeah. The guys that stayed in the air, they brought back into the Air Force. A lot of them were retired or didn't come back in, you know, so...
Yeah, wow.
But there they were. And another great hero I met once, when we were flying our Sabres down at we landed at Trenton, and the runway was slick, mm-hmm. and our first two airplanes went off the end of the runway into the mud, sitting there, and my two, we landed, we're okay, but these transport guys, these young firefighters don't know how to fly airplanes, and they give us shit, you know. Anyway, but we went to the mess, we slunk into the mess, and the bartenders looked at us and said, "Are you those fighter pilots?" And we said, "Yes, sir." And we're not, "Sir, bartender." And he said, "Well, that little old gentleman over there wants to talk to you." Mm-hmm. And I looked over, and I recognized him right away, because it was Air Marshal Billy Bishop, the greatest ace from World War I.
Yeah.
And we're looking across, he waved, "Come on over, boy. Are you those fighter pilots? And we said, "You're flying this fast jet?" "Yes, sir." He said, "Sit down." And he bought us a drink. Billy Bishop. He says, I want you to tell me, can you're flying this new jet. Yes, sir. It's called F-86 Sabre. And I understand that you can go faster than the speed of sound." "Yes, sir. We can do that in a dive. You know, we roll over at 40,000 feet, pointer down in full power, and about 35,000. The Mach meter goes up by one, and it'll give a little click, and now you know you're going faster than the speed of sound. And you're up to about 1.01 or 1.02 going straight down. And then you have to pop your dive brakes to get out of it, because you don't want to go, because the wings will tear off if you get down too heavy the areas."
Yeah.
And the sonic boom leaves the aircraft, which builds up behind the wing, and it goes down and it makes a huge crash on the ground like a thunderclap. Anyway, and that's how you get out of doing your supersonic run. And he said, "Wow. God, that's fantastic," he said. And then he wanted to know about our guns. "We have a 650 caliber machine gun, sir, a three beside each leg, three on the right, three on the left. And he said, "And we can do 1,200 rounds a minute when we're firing one." He said, "Holy crap," he said. "If I had one of those guns, I would have got ripped off." And you're looking at Billy Bishop from World War I, who's the greatest ace of all time.
Yeah.
And he wanted a 50 caliber machine gun. Because they had 303s in those days.
Yeah, not quite as powerful, huh?
But you know, so this is one of the stories that are so fantastic to make these greatest aviators of all time. And you know, you're standing talking to them.
You met a legend, basically. Yeah,
well, that was in 1952, or 51. And then Billy Bishop died in 56, so we did have, and the stupidity of I didn't have my camera, you know, to take a picture of Billy Bishop, or with us.
Yeah.
Because, God, you know, that's something that's so rare, you know.
That guy, I think, will probably ascend into folklore kind of history, and as, like, you know, a great hero. But, what a guy.
Well, Billy Bishop, they brought him in during War II, because he'd retired. I think he was working... He was running Texaco or something. He was became quite wealthy, and they brought him in and made him an air vice marshal or air marshal to pin wings on guys. Mm. And some of the guys that I knew got their wings pinned on by Billy Bishop, which is something else again. You know, crap. You know, that's hard stuff.
An honor. Yeah.
So there you go.
Wow. Cool. So where was the police station in Canada again? The name of it?
Oh, this was in Trenton.
Trenton. Okay.
Trenton was our. Been our air transport command base.
And you were from the West Coast originally?
Yeah, but we were flying out of Uplands then, which was at RCF Station Uplands in Ottawa.
Okay.
Our squadron formed there. We were forming our Sabre squadrons there before we sent them across the pond.
Right, okay.
And
so did you take part in Operation Leapfrog then? Did you fly?
Yeah. So our squadron was based there. The other squadron was at St. Hubert with 427 Squadron, and the third squadron that we went with on Leapfrog was 413 Squadron, and they were based at Bagotville. And when our time came to fly them across the pond, we all flew our airplanes to Goose Bay, Labrador. Mm-hmm. We met up there. And we had 56 airplanes there on the ground in Labrador, and this was March. Could you stop for a sec? Get my logbook so I don't get the right dates.
Yeah. It's cool you still have all this stuff. So
your logbook tells the whole your life, eh?
Oh, yeah.
It's everything.
And wow.
So, you know, even your first solo, which is in here and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So now we go to the Sabre days. We actually flew an airplane called the Texan.
That was the trainer. Huh?
Yeah, it was the trainer.
Yeah.
It's an American version of our Harvard.
Right, okay.
And we ran out of Harvards because of the... Canada, we were building them in, I think, in Fort William or North Lakehead. Mm-hmm. And they didn't produce enough of them because after World War One or Two, our Air Force went down to almost zero. We didn't have it. And then the Korean War started. They said, oops, we better get going again. So that's when they decided to get to join NATO.
Yeah.
And in NATO, we promised NATO, Canada, this is 1948 or 49, 48, we promised NATO an armored brigade. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any tanks. And an air division. We didn't have any fighters. So they went and said, our country, air division, or our national defense, found out the best tank that was available at the time was a British tank called the Centurion.
Centurion, yeah. Yeah. So
they ordered the Centurions, and then they looked around and said, what's the best fighter? And they said, well, the best fighter coming along is called an F-86. It was built by North American down in the States. And so then, fortunately, the Korean War started in June of 50, and then we were getting into the Sabre, because our first jet in Canada was called the Vampire.
Right, I heard of the De Havilland, right?
De Havilland Vampire. It was a nice airplane.
Yeah.
I loved the little sucker, but there's the Vampire.
That's a Vampire there, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So very distinctive looking plane.
Yeah, so I flew the Vamp first, and then we got on the Sabres at graduated. Then
so you had quite a lot of hours in the Vampire.
Well, the Vamp was only we only got 50 hours. You know, they're hour trips, at a time. But I flew it 40 or 50 times.
Yeah.
And it was a great little machine. It had 420 millimeter cannon.
Yeah.
Right under your ass. When you fired all four, you could feel the whole airplane because it was such a small airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
you moved over to the Sabre.
We went over to Sabres and we were transferred out of Vamps to RCF Station Uplands to form 434 Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we met our commanding officer, who was a wing commander. His name was Jack Mitzner, and he was an ace from World War II. He had wear two DFCs, and he had a Dutch DFC. Because he was in that push through Holland, and the Canadians
did a lot there.
Germans out of Holland. And so now we're looking at another ace. And the base commander was a group captain named Bud Malloy. And he was another ace from World War II. So you're meeting the
surrounded
great fighter pilots from the war. And so we formed our squadron at Uplands, and here we are flying it. We started flying. The first time we flew one was on the 19th of August, 1952. I flew it for 45 minutes. And
what were your thoughts on it the first time you flew it? What did you think?
Oh, God, you know.
You liked it?
Well, it was a modern machine. Like, a Vampire was really a old world type with cables running the ailerons and rudders and things. Well, this was, it had hydraulic controls. Because at supersonic speed, you couldn't move the ailerons or elevators without assistance.
Yeah.
So there we were with it. So it had things like that, which was revolutionary.
Yeah.
And for an airplane to go faster than sound, it was another thing. Holy Jesus. Wow. Yeah. And we had a couple of relics from left by the squadron that left before us. And then we picked up new ones at Canadair in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
We'd fly down to Canadair and pick them up.
Wait, so the ones that you had before, were they F-86 American ones?
They were F-86Es, the E models.
And then you got the Canadian ones with the more powerful engine.
Well, De Havilland or Canadair, or it was called General Dynamics owned Canadair. And they made a deal with North American Aviation in the United States that we would produce the F-86 in Canada under license, which we did.
Right.
And it was the E model. So that's what they were building. in Canada and Montreal then. And later on, they had some smart engineers there, and they produced a wing which was almost a laminar flow wing, which was revolutionary, and was thin, and a new engine which was built in Toronto by Aranda, mm-hmm. which gave us another 3,000 pound thrust over the E model of the Sabre. The Sabre, the F-86, the General Electric engine we had in our first Sabres was only 5,200 pounds thrust. Mm-hmm. So now we're, and it was another year before we got our Mark V, they called them, but now we're up to almost 8,000 pounds thrust engine.
Yeah.
So that's a huge.
And so these F-86Es, would in Canadian nomenclature, would that be the Mark II? Is that the equivalent? Or
no.
I'm confused as to how that works. So I'm familiar with the Mark II, Mark V, and Mark VI Sabres.
Well, this was considered, the Sabre we had were considered the Mark II.
Okay.
We called it the E model. Well, it was the E model.
And that was the first one we had.
Mark II was the Canadian version, derivation.
Okay, I see.
So, but it was the Sabre E that we got first. Mm-hmm. And then, we flew the Sabre E all across the pond and all that stuff, so... Mm-hmm. You can see all our training from 52 all through September. We flew quite a lot, which was good, mm-hmm. through to 1952, there's Bud Malloy. Mm-hmm. And then into November, and then we did our...
And we're in 1953 now.
Well, I'm still in Uplands. 434 Squadron Upland. And then we go on here, and where we flew, here we are, Leapfrog 3. So until 1953, we flew the Sabre out of Upland, Ontario, near Ottawa. And so, well, you can see, we're getting ready for this Leapfrog. We did the formation. There's 12 airplanes we're flying around. And then we... here we are, Uplands to Goose Bay. That's where we went on the... There it is, March the 7th, 1953. That's when we all met up with the other two squadrons in Labrador. Mm-hmm. And then Goose Bay to Blue US 1. We flew... let's get a map.
Oh, to Greenland, I see. And then from there to Iceland.
Yeah, can you... I'll get... thing for you.
Sure.
I got all the stuff around, but someplace.
So from Goose Bay to Blue West 1 Greenland to Keflavik, Iceland. And this happened over the course of a week or two, I said? The whole Leapfrog operation? Did you have some time to see Iceland?
Well, we didn't really need it. We flew above everything. Well, I can't find it right now.
Oh, yeah, that's okay.
I guess I can. There it is right there. Yeah. This gives a schematic of the map that
we
flew.
There we go. Yeah.
Now, here we are. We flew to our bases at Goose Bay. We came up this way, Goose Bay. And then to Narsarsuaq is there in Greenland. Mm-hmm. Blue West 1, and from there to Keflavik, Iceland, and from there to, we landed at North, I'll tell you about that, up, and then we flew to our bases in Germany. So that's the kind of route we took.
Yeah.
There.
A refueling long journey.
We had to refuel because we didn't have enough gas to get to.
And then did you have drop tanks on the time?
Yeah, we carried drop. We had on the first E model, we carried 100 gallons drop tanks, two of them. And then when we got our Mark Vs, we carried a 200 gallon drop tank. And so it was give us a lot more. We had about an hour and a half range.
Okay.
So you can see the...
So it was a thirsty horse.
We flew at 2 hours and 5 minutes going from Uplands to Goose Bay. And then an hour 45 from Goose Bay to Blue US 1 in Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
And then an hour 50 going from Blue US 1 to Kef, Iceland.
And what's your kind of cruising speed? How fast would you be going?
We'd cruise about about 0.85 Mach. And we didn't fly on this airspeed, we flew on the Mach.
And how was that translated?
Well, it'd be about 400 miles an hour.
Okay.
Like the speed of sound at 40,000 feet is about 670 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're flying a percentage of that, 100% would be, Mach 1 would be 670 miles an hour.
Oh, I see.
And on the deck, it's 706, like here, the speed of sound would be 760 miles an hour. So it diminishes as you go higher because the air is thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And so... But the Mach, we flew on Mach all the time because the airspeed was too fluctuating. So
yeah.
If you want to go, anyway. So, but we flew at the best cruise altitude and speed because we needed to go to at least 40,000 to get, because that's where we burn less gas and from one place to the next. So we flew up there at 45,000 or I forget.
That's quite high.
Yeah. Blue was one to Keflavik. I remember that was a shitty. Well, the weather was iffy at Keflavik when we took off. And we had to climb up to the ice cap in Greenland was 12,000 feet high. Mm-hmm. So we had to climb up out from Blue US One. We climbed, heading kind of towards Goose Bay, but we climbed to get up to 12,000 and kept on climbing to 40,000 and then headed for Keflavik. And I remember. I passed my point of no return. I had three other guys locked onto me. I was leading a section. And I called in the Kef, and our wing commander, Gervais, I remember his very well. He was kind of in charge of the leapfrog. And he said, I'm in the Keflavik Tower, and the weather's gone bad. They'll have to return.
Mm-hmm.
And we had what they call a PNR, point of no return, and I passed that.
Oh.
So we said, oops. So I said, Roger, sir, but we're coming in. We're past the point of no return. He said, Roger. Anyway, so the guys behind me had to turn back and go back to back to Greenland, back to Blue US 1. So I continued on.
By yourself?
Well, my guys were locked onto me.
So the four of you.
My section,
yeah.
So I was leading. So, and so we called in. It was a teardrop approach, and all we had was navigation was called an ADF. It was a radio compass that we'd lock onto the frequency of like Keflavik, and our needle would be pointing at it. And then we'd do our let down and head in. We know how to do that. So the guys were locked onto me because there was 30,000 feet of cloud I remember we had to go through to get, and then we broke out about 300 to 400 feet over the water. And Iceland was ahead of us somewhere, so oops. and there was a raging storm because we could see white caps below us.
Wow.
And so eventually there was Keflavik, the Iceland. Well, we found the island, and the runway started right at the edge of the water. So I had the guy, we did a left-hand approach, they call it. And I came in and I landed, and I thought I'd blown a tire because my right wing was up. And it was a 65 knot crosswind on the runway, so I told the guys behind me, use right aileron to get your wing down. So, you know, so anyway, so everybody landed successfully.
Yeah.
And so we got in there and we got stuck there for another week in Keflavik. But it was kind of interesting because it was a harrowing trip, and you know, you're kind of running out of gas, but you don't even think about things like that when you're 22 years old. So. Hummingbird up there.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, so we and then we spent and then we refueled got ourselves organized for the trip from there to Scotland. And I remember in Scotland, we went to Kinlawson. We were supposed to go into Prestwick in Scotland, but it was down. So our flight took us from Keflavik to an RAF base called Kinlawson. And it was a base that they're flying a big old airplane like called a Shackleton, which was a maritime patrol aircraft, looking for submarines. And so we landed at Kinloss, and they didn't have jet fuel, so we filled up with avgas.
Mm.
And then we flew.
And the planes were still okay to run on that?
Well, it ran okay. Yeah, it was a little, it just ran a little hot, but we just had to. We had to fly back to, over to Prestwick to get jet fuel, which we did. We were stuck there for 2 days in Kinloss, and then I forget where Kinloss. April 6th, So now we flew to, over to Kinloss to Prestwick. That only took us 40 minutes. And then we got jet fuel. We spent the night there and then headed off back to our new base, which was in Germany.
In Zweibrücken, was it?
Zweibrücken, Germany.
Yeah.
So that we landed there on April the 7th, 1953.
And was that your first time in Germany?
First time in Germany, yeah.
And what were your impressions when you were flying to Germany? What were your feelings?
We're going into a place that we bombed the crap out of during World War II.
Not too long ago.
And this is 1953, so, you know, the war was over. And, you know, later on when we got a place like Mannheim and Karlsruhe, they're so blown to hell, you know. But there's a lot of damage in England, too, you know. So, the wars are so stupid because all they do is just
destroy
everything, you know. Yeah. Stupid.
So what was it when you were based in Germany? What was like? I guess when you had time off to go to like out to the cities, bars, whatever. How were Canadian pilots perceived by the Germans there?
Well, it was kind of funny. We didn't really know, and none of us had German. So I remember the first time we found a. So I said, "Let's go down to Gasthof downtown." Mm-hmm. So, and we had to. I don't know how we got someone. One of the guys had a car or something. Anyway, so we drove downtown to a Gasthof and went into the a bunch of Germans sitting there drinking beer, and one of them got up and stood up and said, "Heil Hitler!" We said, "Oh
really?
My God!" You know, and we said, "Oops," and the owner of the Gasthof came over and said, "Never mind him. It's just an old drunk. And make sure you guys come back, eh?" Because there was a little, we didn't care, though. It was just that there was a resentment that we thought.
Yeah.
But later on, we found out that when we got to know the Germans and they got to know us, they knew we weren't there as occupation. We were there to protect them from Russians.
Right.
So
now
it was a different phase altogether, that we were there to protect the Germans. And so it became guys married German girls and they became our best friends.
I was going to ask about that. Like, were there any girlfriends of guys or anything?
Yeah. As time went on over the next couple of years, the guys were marrying German girls and things. So.
Wow.
And we got to know, our best Gasthof was called Mama Jake's.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go down there Friday nights and with his family. And one of his daughters married one of our guys. And so, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how well the Germans really took it. So years later, I went back in Zweibrücken and I went to see the mayor, the Oberbürgermeister, and his number two there was the guy running the tourist bureau, and he said, "Come on in." So I went downtown to their offices, and they opened up these big scrapbooks, and they had all of the newspaper articles about the Canadians in there, and it was wonderful. And they said,
"Wow.
You're our best friends." And that's nice. How it was
in
Zweibrücken, Germany. And we just loved it there, you know.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was a new world and a new place. And we flew next to the Iron Curtain, which is
not too
far away.
I was going to ask about that. When you were flying over there, did it feel like there was a war imminent at any time?
We didn't trust the Russians then, like we don't trust them now.
Mm-hmm.
We would fly right to the buffer, the border, the Iron Curtain, which ran through Czechoslovakia. That was our nearest border, Czechoslovakia, because Germany was still divided, East Germany and West Germany, and there was a, they had highways going from Frankfurt into Berlin on the ground, and there was a couple air corridors, one from Hamburg into Berlin and one from Frankfurt into Berlin.
And was it a pretty straight line, like you couldn't fly over?
Yeah, an airway. It was called an airway.
Okay.
And so they were protected so civilian aircraft could fly down these airways. And then when the Germans, they stopped the road transportation, and that's when they called the Berlin Airlift happened.
Right, yeah.
And then the Americans put up everything they got with the transport aircraft to fly stuff into Tempelhof in Berlin, and it was a massive airlift.
Yeah.
Because they provided them with food and everything, and then the Russians finally capitulated and let our guys in there on the road. So anyway, but it was a massive airlift. But one time I remember the Germans shot down an airplane called British Airways airplane called an Elizabethan, mm-hmm. and they killed 44 people. And they said it wasn't in the corridor, and that was a lie because that's what the Russians do. You know, they're so bad.
Yeah.
Anyway. Anyway, and they killed 44 people with a loop, so they weren't fooling around.
No.
And we a lot of the time we flew with what we call hot guns. They're ready to fire at any time, and which we did. And then they made a buffer zone. When we got our new radar state over there, they put in a big radar at Metz in France, and it could see the Iron Curtain.
Hmm.
And so they made a buffer zone. We weren't supposed to go within 25 miles of the Iron Curtain. Because when we first got there, we could see the Russians on the other side with their MiG-15s,
yeah.
and there we were.
we could see each other.
We'd wave at them, and anyway, so...
Would, you could actually wave at them, and they... Would
well,
they?
Yeah, well, because the Korean War was on this time, and we were shooting down the MiG-15s 10-1 in Korea, so we knew we had a better airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with the MiG-15, it had a 30-millimeter cannon, which is a big cannon, and
yeah.
two 23-millimeter, so it had... one of our guys who was in Korea said, when they fire that big 30-millimeter at you, can see this big ball going by your by your canopy and say, whoops, don't want to hit by one of those, because one of them would kill a Sabre, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, but we knew what the MiG was like, and when we, if you got it down to 25,000, it was dead meat, we could kill them all. But above that, they were light, and they could fly higher than us.
Mm.
So, until we got our Mark V Sabres, and then we were above the...
That's when you had more power.
Well above the MiG-15s. They didn't like that very much. So, so there we are.
So you guys felt pretty confident then, if they're pretty confident.
Oh, yeah. We were kind of... You know, all of us wanted to go to Korea and test ourselves.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I was the next guy selected to go to Korea when the war stopped, and I was pretty disappointed. Well, we used to, we did a lot of flying.
The plane, was there anything about it that you didn't like?
No, not really.
Not really, it was just a fantastic plane, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, when we got our Mark V's and Mark VI's, we were the best freighter in Europe.
You know,
the Americans had, when we first got over there, they provided other countries like the French and an F-84, and it was a straight wing airplane. It was a kind of a dog, and then the French were flying an airplane called the Ouragan. The Ouragan was another straight wing jet, and eventually they took the Ouragan and swept back, and then they got into the Mystère, and the Mystère series were really great airplanes. So I saw something later on in one of my tours. I was in Israel, and the Israelis had these Mystères, and they were a great flying machine. But the Brits were trying to build an airplane that they had a Supermarine Swift, which started, and then they built the Hawker Hunter.
Mm.
And the Hawker Hunter was it really wasn't as good as the Sabre, but it had a 10,000-pound thrust engine in it, and so it could push it up pretty good. And I saw Hawker Hunters later on another tour on active duty. So all kinds of things. Canada had the best air force in NATO in the early 50s.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, yeah.
And then we went into the 104 airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in the nuke business, which is kind of dumb, anyway.
So the F-86 then, so the inside, like the seat and everything, was it pretty comfortable on like long flights? Or was
oh, yeah.
It was fine?
Well, you know, we only did an hour and a half, you know, okay, so we didn't have a P tube in it, so you made sure you went before you got in. But the Mark V, now we're up, well, you take it to 50,000 feet, and you can stay up there for 4 hours almost. And so that was kind of long, but no, we never really worried about that.
And the
cockpits were great, and the flying it was easy. Didn't have an automatic pilot in it, so you're constantly on control. Yeah. So
when you're up at that high altitude, like 50,000 feet, could you see the curvature of the Earth? Or?
I took a picture of a friend of mine, I have a record of it. I said we're at 55,000, and you can see just behind him the curvature of the Earth, and where the sky really starts to turn, but it turns black up there.
Yeah. Right?
And so that's how high we were, you know.
So the sky, when you were there, it was actually black above you?
Well, it starts getting that way. It was really dark blue, dark.
Wow,
dark.
That's cool.
But the thing was, is we didn't have, and we really didn't understand it, and there was not a lot of press about it, that we shouldn't have been above 48,000, because you need a pressure suit above 48,000. Because above that, and they'd said, if you lose your canopy or oxygen or whatever, your pressurization, your blood will boil, and we didn't know what that meant. So, anyway, so but we were pretty cocky in those days, and they didn't tell us that it was a real danger if you lost your canopy. They didn't tell us
that you would die in that case.
Well, not really, because if you had your, we had oxygen masks, of course, and pressure oxygen. So if you lost your canopy, well, nobody did. No, so I don't recall it. When I hit the bird, which was another story, I was low level.
I hope to hear that story later on. Yeah,
so that didn't matter. But later on, when we found out that we should have had pressure suits above 48,000, but no one considered that in those days.
Yeah. So you had, were the sabers heated on the inside, or did you just have like really good flying clothes? Were they heated on the inside? Like,
We had a heater, but I don't recall using it very much.
Did you have like a thick jet flying jacket and stuff?
Yeah, we had a, no, we had a, how did we heat the airplane? I forget, because it didn't seem to matter.
It's one of those things you don't think about.
Yeah. Well, we wear long johns, you have a flying suit on, you'd have boots and big socks, and a jacket over your flying suit, and gloves, of course.
And I guess the excitement of flying the plane to keep you warm, too.
I never really considered these trips across the pond on leapfrog. Wore a thing called a poopy suit, which was an immersion suit that if you landed in the water, if you had to eject over the water, the thing would keep you alive in the icy North Atlantic for a few minutes.
A few minutes?
Yeah.
That's it.
Because if you didn't have it, you're seconds, you know, because the water's so cold. And the poopy suit was hard collared around your neck and over your hands, so you wouldn't, and it was like a total emergency, and you could go and not get wet.
Yeah.
Inside.
And so, only a few minutes. Were there ships on the route that you were flying? So if someone had to bail.
Not really. We had an American between. I remember between Bluey, Greenland, and Keflavik. They had an airplane called the SA-16, and later on we had them here at Komak called an Albatross, and they had a. They're a flying boat, mm-hmm. and they would put out a little beacon. But I remember it was very weak and it wasn't really much good because the beacon at Keflavik was strong. And so when we got closer, we didn't have to worry about duck butts. They call them duck butts.
Mm.
So, but really nothing to...
nothing to see.
Nothing to navigate on. No.
So if you had to bail, there was a good chance you wouldn't make it.
Oh, probably, yeah. And we never lost an airplane. And after us, there came an outfit called the Overseas Ferry Unit, the OTU, OFU. And they flew sabers across the pond to replace our old airplane.